In the book of Hebrews, and if you have your Bibles or your phone or your iPad or whatever it is that you use, open it to the book of Hebrews, and let's read a couple of verses, shall we? I haven't forgotten communion. We're going to do it at the end. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into the heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Did you see that? Therefore, and let us. In the light of all we have, in the light of who Jesus is, let us hold firmly. We want a motivation for doing things. Well, there's our motivation. And that's really what we're looking at today. And remember the overall structure of the book? These people were wanting to backslide and go back to the old. And he says, don't do that. Hold firmly to the faith you profess. And the reason you do that, well, look at who Jesus is. Look at what he's done. Therefore, let us. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Now every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent them in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins as well as for the sins of the people. And no one takes this honor on himself, but he receives it when called by God, just as Aaron was. In the same way, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to him, you are my son, today I've become your father. There was a call in his life. And he says in another place, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. We're not going to look at Melchizedek today. When we get to chapter 7, we'll look at him. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, talking about Jesus, son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered, and once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. The law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. The law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the reality themselves. Now, I don't like scary movies. I'll just be honest with you, but I want you to think of a scary movie. And I want you to think of a child who's kind of crouching behind a box or something like this, crouching behind it, and she can hear the baddie. She can hear him moving around the house, and she can hear the footsteps coming closer, and she's crouched, and she's hoping she's not going to be seen. But then she sees the shadow. I mean, you can feel it's a scary movie, eh? You can see the shadow coming, and the shadow falls on her. Now, a shadow is nothing to be scared of, because after all, a shadow is absolutely nothing. But while the shadow is nothing, the shadow is a promise of what is coming. Now, this is not a great promise when it's a baddie that's going to give substance to the shadow, but the shadow lets that little girl know that the man, the reality, is coming. The law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. And so we have the complex and complicated ceremonies of the Old Testament. And many Christians start to read them and give up. But we shouldn't give up, because you see, they are a shadow. And understanding about the shadow understanding that complicated and hard to understand Old Testament stuff helps us understand the reality when it comes, helps us to understand the teaching of the New Testament. Now, I've spoken to you before about the big picture. And here is the big picture, that which is happening in history. God created us to have relationship with himself. God created us and he put us in paradise. He put us in the garden. But we were not satisfied with what God had given us. We rebelled because we actually wanted to be like God. We were kicked out the garden. But God immediately set about the process through which relationship between us and himself could be restored. Or to put it another way, God set about the process of building a bridge to span the chasm caused between us and God. And working within the messiness of history, working within the fickleness of human relationships, all complicated by free will, God is still doing that. That's the big picture. God is busy working in all this to bring us back to the place where we can go back to paradise, back to Eden, back to the garden, and enjoy relationship with himself. And in the Old Testament, we see the shadow, we see the form, in shadow form, what God planned to do, how God was planning to build this bridge to restore the relationship with us. Which is why we read that the law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. They point, in the Old Testament, they point to what is coming. And so we have shadows in the Old Testament, like the temple. The temple is a shadow of the place where we will find the presence of God. And we have the sacrifices. The sacrifices are simply the shadow of the ultimate sacrifice which Jesus was to become. And relevant to what I want to say this morning, we have the high priest foreshadowing the work that Jesus was going to do. But we don't only see these people and what they are foreshadowing. As we look at the high priest, we see in our text that there were qualifications laid out for the high priest, qualifications which the reality, Jesus, would have to meet, would have to fulfill if he were going to be the substance to the shadow. Shadow after shadow after shadow, all pointing to the reality which was to come, because the law is only the shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. Now, in our text, we find several qualifications of the high priest. Here is one of them. Every high priest is selected from among the people. And in that qualification, we actually see two things. We see that a high priest doesn't make a career choice. That I want to be high priest, he doesn't do that. He is selected by others. He cannot decide on his own to be the high priest. No one takes this honor on himself, but he receives it when he's called by God. But as important, the high priest must be able to identify with the people among whom he serves. And so every high priest is selected from among the people. He has to be one of the people. He has to understand them. If he's going to be able to deal gently with them, he must understand the people, which introduces a second qualification. He is to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. Important qualification. He must be compassionate if he's going to be the high priest. You see, people are going to be coming to the high priest, and the reason they're going to be coming to the high priest is because they have failed in some way to live up to God's standards. And so the priest, who is probably a man of integrity, must yet be able to show compassion to these people who have failed. He must be approachable. He must not become angry or impatient with the people who are coming to offer sacrifices for their failure. And so to facilitate this, he must be chosen from among the people among whom he's going to be serving. And to make this point clearer, the author reminds us of a truth. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as for the sins of the people. You see, the high priest cannot be there with an arrogance or with a pride or with a "I've got it all together" attitude. He can't do that, and he won't be able to do that because he's from among the people. And before he can offer anything for the people, he has to offer something on his own behalf because he himself is a sinner. The high priest, he didn't choose himself, and he's chosen for his compassion. And let's not forget that these Old Testament requirements for the high priest are only a shadow of the good things that are to come, not the realities themselves. So, those are the qualifications. But we also see in shadow form the functions of the high priest. Look, every high priest is to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. Among the functions of the high priest of particular significance is this one, to offer sacrifices for the sins of the people. Now, the law is clear. God is a holy God. God is perfect and God is pure in every way. And the Ten Commandments which were given are a reflection of the character of God. The Ten Commandments also give an indication of the kind of behavior which would be acceptable to God. He's a holy God. But our God is also a realistic God. God knows none of us will be able to perfectly keep the Ten Commandments. Nevertheless, when the people failed to keep the commandments, even though God knew they wouldn't be able to keep them, he still wants a relationship with them. But even though he knew they wouldn't be able to keep them, that caused a barrier. And they were now unable to have a relationship with God. But our holy God, who is a realistic God in terms of our inability to keep the law, is also a loving God. And in his love, he longs for relationship with us nevertheless. And being realistic, he knows that if he's going to leave us to our own devices, well, that relationship is just never going to happen. And so God gave the sacrifices, so that when the people failed to live up to the Ten Commandments, to God's standards, they would be able to go to the priest who would offer the sacrifice on their behalf. And God, in his incredible grace, would accept the sacrifice, and relationship between himself and the offerer would be restored. That's what it means, that every high priest is to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. And so the function of the high priest was to maintain a way for sinful people, that's you and me, to approach a holy God. I've spoken to you once before about a pontifex. Remember what a pontifex is? Well, you don't have to remember. It's a Latin word for priest. But do you remember what that word means? A bridge builder. That's literally what the word means. And that is a description of the function of a priest. A priest is literally one who builds a bridge between us, sinful humanity, and God. And by offering the gifts and sacrifices to God on behalf of the people, that's exactly what the priest is doing. He's building a bridge between humankind and God. Now, let's remind ourselves again about what's going on here. The law, that's these things about which we have been speaking, the law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming. They are not the reality themselves. Everything we've spoken about this morning so far is simply a shadow. It's pointing to something. The high priest, selected from among his own people, the high priest, compassionate because he's aware of his own failure. The high priest, a bridge builder, restoring relationship through sacrifice, the relationship between humankind and God. And the law, these things, the law is a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. Which brings us to the place where we can ask the question, what or who is the reality which is coming? Well, our text tells us, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into the heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith that we profess. We have seen that the qualification and function of the earthly high priest, the shadow of the high priest to come, we've seen those qualifications. But in Jesus, we see not the shadow, we see the reality. And we see that he is a great high priest. The writer of this letter wants us to separate in our minds the high priest from the great high priest, who is Jesus, the reality he was coming. So we're told we don't have a high priest, but he is the great high priest. That great high priest is different from the shadow, and this is further seen by the statement that he's one who has ascended to heaven. That's just another way of saying that he's right now in the presence of God. That's almost proof of his greatness, that is where he is. He's ascended to the heavens. He's with God. And then we are told in that he is human. Because the writer here uses the human name of Jesus. He speaks about Jesus, our great high priest, his human name. He wants us to understand the humanity of Jesus. He was human. He was from among us. But he's Jesus, the Son of God. He's also divine. Jesus, the one who right now is in the presence of God. Jesus, who is the divine Son of God. Jesus, who is the great high priest. Jesus is the reality of which the earthly high priest was simply a shadow. Simply a shadow. But as we look at Jesus, the reality, he continues to give substance to the shadow. Look, Jesus, the divine Son of God, became a man. And he lived among us so that he could be chosen from among the people just as the earthly high priest was chosen from among the people. Jesus left his throne in heaven. Jesus was born of Mary in a stable. Jesus lived the life of each one of us. And as a result of that, the writer can say of Jesus, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who was tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Jesus became one of us. Jesus was subject to the temptations and trials which we experience. And because Jesus knows what it's like to be tempted, he understands. He understands how we feel. When we come failed and feeling failures, Jesus says, I understand how you feel. I was there. I experienced those very things that you experienced. Of course, he did it without sin. Which means that he's able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray. And that's us. We're the ones who are ignorant and going astray. Jesus understands, and he's able to deal gently with us. A writer really wants to make this point of the compassion of Jesus. He really wants us to understand that Jesus is able to feel. He really wants to encourage us to come to Jesus and not feel embarrassed or shy because of what we've done. He wants to encourage us to come to Jesus. And not only does he want to encourage us to come to Jesus no matter what we've done, he also wants to encourage us to hold firm to what we profess. He doesn't want us to find things hard or find something more attractive. He wants us to recognize who Jesus is so that we will hold firmly to our profession. And so our writer takes us to the evening before the crucifixion. Jesus and his disciples have just had supper. Jesus has shown by the breaking of bread that symbolized what was going to be happening to him the next day. He symbolized for them by breaking the bread that his body would be broken. At the supper, he has shown them that the wine in that third cup, the cup of redemption, symbolized the kind of death that he was going to die the next day on the cross, when literally his blood would be shed as he died for us. And after that supper, Jesus, we read, went out into the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples. And he says to James, Peter, and John, he says, come and pray with me now. Now you wait there and pray with me while I go and pray by myself. And Jesus goes off alone to pray. Or what Jesus prayed about, we do not know. But we do know that Jesus also prayed that he might be spared the agony of the cross. How do we know that? Because he said, take this cup away from me. And then he returns to his disciples. And instead of finding them praying with him, he finds them asleep. So Jesus goes back to the place of prayer. Once again, Jesus faced the temptation. He could have called a legion of angels to come and take him out of that situation. Take this cup away from me. He prayed again. Take it away. And yeah, our writer of this letter to the Hebrews adds something which we don't know from the Gospels. He tells us that Jesus offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. Jesus was in agony, in torment in the garden as he was tempted not to do the Father's will. Take it away, he said. I don't want to go through this. And in the fervency of his prayer, in the fervency of his wrestling, wanting to ask the angels to come and rescue him, we are told that Jesus was brought to the point of sweating drops of blood. That's what the gospel writers tell us. What's the point of all this? Jesus understands. And because Jesus understands the struggles of humanity, we are able to approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we can receive mercy and find grace to help in time of trouble. And so, in a way that infinitely surpasses the compassion foreshadowed by the human priests, Jesus, who is real reality, is our compassionate high priests. Earthly high priests were a shadow, a faint shadow as it turns out, of Jesus the reality, the great high priest. Which brings us to the final point. The earthly high priests, the shadow of the one to come, represent us in matters related to God to offer gift and sacrifice. So, using the animal sacrifice, they were bridge builders. Remember the pontifex, the bridge builder, the priest? But remember, we also saw that before the earthly high priest could offer sacrifices on our behalf, they had to offer sacrifices for their own sin, for their own failure. Before they could be bridge builders for the people, they had to build a bridge for themselves. Is Jesus the great high priest, who is the reality which earthly priests were but a shadow? Is Jesus also a pontifex? Is he a bridge builder? Is he? Yes, he is. But here's the difference. Jesus didn't offer a sacrifice. Jesus didn't offer a sacrifice. Jesus himself became the sacrifice, which was sufficient once and for all to bridge that chasm between us and God, caused by our rebellion, caused by our failure. And I want you to picture Jesus lying across that chasm. I want you to picture Jesus himself, the bridge between our sinfulness and a holy God. The bridge across whom we can enter into the presence of our holy, realistic, loving God. I want you to keep that picture in mind, because you see, even if everything that I have said today is obscure, even if you think it's irrelevant because it's about the Old Testament and you cannot understand the Old Testament, even if that is so, if you only take away this picture of Jesus himself bridging the gap between us and a holy God, you would have understood enough. You would have understood enough. And if you are still thinking about the questions that Jan sent out a couple of weeks ago about why we come to church, about why we do things, about why we do anything for the Lord, if you're still wondering, well, why do we tell others about Jesus? Why would we be willing to serve as volunteers in the church? Why would we be willing to attend a cell group? Why would we be willing to put our hard-earned money into the church's bank account? If you're wondering, why would I do that? If you wonder, do I have sufficient reason for that? Well, let me tell you, everything we do is done in response to what Jesus has done for us. Everything we do is a grateful response to what Jesus has done for us. Everything we do is responding to the fact that Jesus is our high priest, is our bridge builder. Everything we do is in response to what he has already done for us. Is there anything that he could ask us to do that is too much? We're going to have communion now, and we're going to remember what Jesus has done for us. So if those who are serving communion with me would come to the table,